This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC. Much of this programme today will be focused on events 10 years ago, and let's go back and look at how the news broke when you were listening to LBC.
Nothing is going to stop us savouring this moment of having won the Olympic Games for London.
Need to go immediately to the newsroom. It's 9:14. You're listening to LBC. Tom Bateman's got some breaking news. Tom?
Very, very sketchy and a confused picture, but we have details of some kind of incident in or around Liverpool Street Station.
We're now being told by Scotland Yard that this is a major incident.
Are you actually at Allgate, yeah?
Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm the supervisor at Allgate. We've just had a big explosion. We've evacuated.
They weren't just closing the stations, but literally quite aggressively trying to get everybody as far away as possible. They've closed the road between Aldgate Station and Liverpool Street Station.
We all heard an explosion. Everything just disappeared in front of me, and I'm looking at people with blood injuries and walking away from the scene.
We've had three explosions as far as I'm aware.
Yeah.
Are definitely walking injured.
Yeah.
There are possibly fatalities.
There was debris everywhere, people just running.
A policeman guarding that street basically said to me, get out of this area now, a bomb has gone off, I've been picking up dead bodies.
We're just hearing that bombs have gone off at Argate, King's Cross, Liverpool.
Code Amber, the whole network. We're going to stop the whole network. All right, darling,
do it now. No. Code Amber, get them into stage.
Yeah.
And then stand by.
The whole of the tube network has been suspended this morning.
Hi, there's a bus just exploded outside in Tavistock Square, just outside my window.
Tavistock Square?
Yeah, in London. There's people lying on the ground and everything.
Right, and it was an explosion on the bus, was it?
Yeah, there's people lying in the road.
I need you to move this way, please, as quick as you can.
A bomb has gone off on a bus in Russell Square. And there must be some considerable injuries.
Clearly from eyewitnesses' reports on the ground, there are more injured than have at the moment been accounted for.
There's a big hole in the carriage, and there's people lying everywhere, covered in blood, and there was people screaming help. So we couldn't get out.
1 minute minding your own business, bang, and we thought we were on fire. The smell, the smoke, you couldn't breathe, you couldn't see anything.
It has all the indications of a terrorist attack.
As yet, we do not know who or which organisations are responsible for these criminal and appalling acts.
This has been a most terrible and tragic atrocity that has cost many innocent lives.
Watch next week as we bury our dead and mourn them. But see also in those same days new people coming to this city to make it their home, to call themselves Londoners.
And the last voice you heard there was, at the time, London Mayor Ken Livingstone. He's, of course, one of my colleagues now on LBC, and he joins me now. Ken Livingstone, good morning. Now that we know all this time on, Ken, that a couple of these people, the murderers, had crossed the radar, are you satisfied the security services had done all they possibly could?
Well, I suppose the real problem with all of this is that you can't never be 100% certain. When we took the decision to invade Iraq, and the government was warned that this would make a target for terrorism. A huge amount of work went on with the police, security services, and pretty much each year we nipped in the bud a group planning something. About once a year I get a phone call from Sir John Stevens, who was then police commissioner, or Tony Blair, saying we've arrested two or three people. Always a bit amateurish, I have to say. This group was linked to Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda later released the videos that they'd left, the statements they'd made. And, you know, perhaps we've been a bit more lucky, we might have just caught them. But unless you're going to live in some sort of Stalinist state, like 1950s Russia, where everything's bugged all the time and everyone's spied on, in a normal free society, some terrorists will always get through.
A little amateurish, you say, a decade ago, Ken Livingstone. How confident are you that we've moved to a more professional footing now?
Oh, well, things have just got much better, much more sophisticated. We get a huge amount of assistance from and the Muslim community, people who identify as they're worried about someone who might be a risk, might be a threat. But the simple reality with all of this is that if someone's prepared to give their own life in order to take other people's, they have a good chance of succeeding.
What's your abiding memory of 10 years ago, lastly, Kim?
Oh, it was just the fact that we'd had this amazing day before where we'd won the Olympics. There'd been this pretty remarkable party in Singapore the night before. And then this news came through. I got messages from my press officer, Joy Johnson, saying there'd been this power outage. And a few minutes later, she thought it was going to be much worse than that. And I just wanted to be back, to be stuck in Singapore on the other side of the world. But that was just a personal feeling. We've been planning for this for years. And the only decision I actually had to take on that day was the two people saying to me, do you want us to shut the system down until we clear everything over the weekend, or do you want it back up and running tomorrow? And I just thought, as in the war, my parents lived through that. London carried on every day after bombings that often claimed hundreds of lives.
I tell you what, you and I clashed a lot when you were in the office, but in the office, that speech you gave, the hairs went back on the back of my neck listening to it just now, Ken Livingstone. You really nailed that. I think you got the spirit of the city. Good speaking with you. Look forward to speaking to you on happier moments. Ken Livingstone is the former mayor of London, and he was mayor at the time of the bombings. He's now one of my colleagues here on LBC. Of course, you can catch him every Saturday morning here on LBC. Kira Mason was the last survivor to be identified. She was on the Circle Line at Aldgate Station, joins me now. Good morning to you. How are you feeling today?
Good morning. It's a bit of a strange day. I thought I was going to be okay and it was going to be like all the other July the 7th, but actually I'm a little bit emotional is the wrong word, but
I imagine it's because of the way the whole nation seems to be coming together to remember 10 years ago. If it's not too painful for you, can you tell my listeners exactly what happened to you?
I used to work in London, and obviously it started off as a day as any other. I intended to get an earlier train, and in the end didn't, just got my normal train, bombed down to the tube, and just got on the first carriage that was free. And I only remember that because that's what I did every day, but I can't remember anything really,
yes,
apart from somebody in the tube after it had happened saying, what's my name?
Yes.
And I thought I'd said what my name was, but obviously I didn't. You know, it was one of those sort of dreamlike things where you say it in your head, but it doesn't actually come out in speech.
Yes.
And then I don't remember anything until I woke up 3 weeks later.
And I think you were told subsequently by a surgeon that if you'd been just inches closer to the bomber, then you and I wouldn't be having this conversation.
Yeah, they said if I'd have been a foot closer, then I wouldn't be here now.
What are the extent of your injuries?
I lost my left arm up to the elbow. I've got quite severe injuries on my leg. My eardrums got blown out. I broke my right arm. About it, really. It sounds quick, but you know, I think I was in surgery quite a lot in that 3 weeks because they had to keep repairing the arm because it wouldn't heal properly.
Dear God.
Don't know whether your viewers are aware, but if you have an injury like that, the blast kind of affects the tissue.
Yes.
And as I understand it, that was the problem. So although they kept taking skin grafts and repairing it, they had to keep then redoing that until they got to a point where it healed.
As you watch the footage today of the memorial service and other events, obviously your mind will turn to those bombers. How do you feel towards them?
Well, I've always said I think the bombers themselves are duped into doing this. It's the people who radicalise them and make them do those sorts of things that are the people that need to be captured, seen to, whatever you want to call it. You know, the bombers themselves are, I think they're sold this story, they're sold this myth.
Yes.
And, for the glory of whatever, they think they're doing good. But, I mean, obviously, we all know that isn't the case. You know, all they're doing is creating havoc and they want to disrupt everything. But, you know, in the true spirit of everything, people won't let them do that.
Thank you for your time this morning. I appreciate it's very difficult. I hope I've not imposed too much. My regards to your family. Kira Mason is a 7th of July survivor, the last survivor to be identified. She was, as you're telling us, on the Circle Line at Aldgate Station.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Whether you're...
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Right, let's go back to events of 10 years ago. The image of Paul Dadge dashing across a road near Edgware Road tube station with injured passenger Davinia Tuttle, the woman in the mask, is possibly one of the most recognisable images of 7th of July.
My name is Paul Dadge. I was pictured leading Davinia Tuttle across the road from Edgware Road tube station. She got burns and she'd had a burns dressing placed over her face, running across the road whilst holding it onto her face. I just started a job at AOL, based in the West End of London in Hammersmith, and I'd had a cracking 2 weeks, to be honest. I'd been to Live 8, we'd been awarded the Olympics the day before, so there was a real carnival atmosphere and it was a really good place to be. We were told that there'd been some kind of incident at Edgware Road tube station and the train would stop at Baker Street. And got off the train and walked up, swiped out with my Oyster card and left the station. I asked somebody what was happening and they said there'd been some kind of explosion underground and they were just kind of looking around at the pavement. I looked up the street and could see people starting to emerge from the actual tube station at Edgware Road. They were described as being covered in black soot. It was just one police officer there who was trying to cordon off the road, and I'd found this fridge in Marks & Spencer's that was full of bottled water, and with the help of the staff from Marks & Spencer's we basketed it all up and brought it to the doorway and then got everybody to just come straight into the store, and they were given a bottle when they came in so they could just wash the face and, you know, and drink it. Somebody had left a bag unattended to Marks & Spencer's and a police officer had seen this bag and had said he was going to evacuate the store. At that point, it just so happened Davinia was the person who I was with. I just said to her, we need to leave now. And we ran out into the street. I could actually hear the shutters of the cameras going off as we ran across the road. There was no sirens, nobody else coming down. Edgware Road was closed. There was just this big line of photographers. A very, very surreal situation. And I do remember saying to her, I think you're going to be in the newspaper tonight. I had no idea that I'd be in that picture as well. Within minutes of that photo being taken, it was spreading all over the world.
It really was spreading all around the world. Paul Dadge there talking. That image, very much, as I said before the interview, really has become part of the coverage. Such an emblem, really, of what people were doing, regular London, ordinary Londoners, helping others out. John's in Eastbourne. John, what do you remember of 10 years ago?
Well, I just think the most terrible thing of all, Nick, is 10 years ago, and we've heard today that our security services have foiled at least another 50 similar type of attacks. So it would seem our government have learned absolutely nothing, because we're constantly living with this threat the whole time, aren't we?
We are, I'm afraid. We are, and we also learn that support is growing for IS.
Yeah, I think the terrible thing is the fact that this IS flag has been seen flying outside Houses of Parliament, and as far as I know, the perpetrator of that particular abuse against us, I don't think they've been arrested. Nothing's happened to them at all.
You're right.
The whole thing is just totally out of control, really, Nick. It really is, isn't it?
It's very worrying, yes, whether it's out of control, but certainly, I just think that lastly, in 10 years, we've not come forward at all, have we?
No, I honestly think, also, when we look at things like, say, places like Afghanistan, where I was reading a report the other day, the very last Christian church in Afghanistan has been burnt to the ground, you know? It does seem to me that, obviously, with the appeasers we've got in our country, we're always the ones giving in, aren't we, you know? To the Islamic threat is always in our faces every time, you know?
What should we do with this guy we're giving £50,000 to from Egypt?
What should we do with him, you say?
Mm, yeah.
I mean, as I say, I don't honestly think our government have got any answers at all. And it's only just a matter of time before we do get another attack against us, isn't it? And unfortunately, it has to be said, Nick, that when the attack does come, it's going to come from Islamists, isn't it? You know?
Yes, it is. I think if you look anywhere in the world, you look from Tunisia to London to pretty much anywhere else, that is the source of the problem.
You know, also, the other thing I would say, I think, you know, obviously, back in the days when we had the IRA attacks, no IRA man was ever was ever a suicide bomber. I mean, the last time I went down to Gatwick Airport, Nick, to tell you the truth, I thought you go through Gatwick Airport, you walk into the foyer part, there's no security at the initial stage until such times as people check their baggage in. Anybody could walk into Gatwick or Heathrow at the initial stages with a bomb and detonate a bomb in the middle of the foyer. And I think this is something else that has not been addressed. I'm quite amazed it's never happened. God forbid, I hope it never does. But anyone knows if they go to Gatwick, they just can't get off the taxi or whatever, put their case onto a trolley, wheel it into the centre of the foyer area, bang. It could easily happen, couldn't it?
Well, it could, but, I mean, it's not just the airports, is it? Also, you get very crowded major railway stations, you get very crowded theatres or very crowded shopping centres, just about everywhere you can think of. Tessa Jowell has been interviewing the man who was Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair.
Tony Blair, you were Prime Minister on the 7th of July, 2005. Can you just tell us how you heard about the attack on London, where you were, how the information was transmitted to you?
On the 7th of July, I was in Scotland at the Gleneagles Hotel, where we were having the major international summit, the G8 summit. And this was literally the day after we'd won the Olympic bid for Britain. It was a moment of great euphoria for the country. For me, it was a huge moment of joy and hope for the future. And I remember sitting in a room having a bilateral discussion with the president of China when someone came in and handed me a slip of paper which said there's been an incident in London, and you're going to have to come out of the meeting quickly. So I came.
But without saying what kind of incident?
No, without saying what sort of incident it was. And I came out, and then I was told about the first attacks. At the time, it wasn't quite clear exactly what it was. But then within sort of 20, 30 minutes, it became very clear. Then I spoke to Charles Clarke, who was the Home Secretary at the time. And then as the day progressed, it became obvious that this was a, you know, a severe set of terrorist attacks. And then I decided I had to go back to London, which I then did. So I left the G8 summit. I remember Jack Straw was chairing the summit in my absence, and all the main leaders of the world were there at the summit. So I came back down to London. We spent the time there for the rest of the day trying both to make sure that we were doing everything that was possible in the light of the attacks that had taken place, but also we were preparing ourselves for what might be further attacks. There were other warnings coming in. We had to take some very difficult decisions around what happened with public transport in London, with the buses and the tube, and what should we do, and how seriously should we take these other threats that were coming in. So I spent the rest of the day doing that, and then the next day came back up to the summit, where we then got a huge statement of support. I mean, a massive show of solidarity for the international community in support of Britain and in support of the people of London.
That's Tessa Jowell speaking with Tony Blair. In the next hour of the show, we'll hear Tony Blair talking about what happened in the weeks after the 7th of July.
I remember sitting in a room having a bilateral discussion with the president of China when someone came in and handed me a slip of paper which said there's been an incident in London, and you're going to have to come out of the meeting quickly. And I came out, and then I was told about the first attacks. At the time, it wasn't quite clear exactly what it was.
When you got back to London and you were faced with the scale of the catastrophe, what did you think about how this would change the role of the government, the responsibility of government, the response in the future?
There were three things that occurred to me immediately. The first was to try and bring people together. I mean, this was obviously an Islamist terrorist attack. On the other hand, I knew that the vast majority of Muslims, not just in London, but in the whole of the country, would be appalled and shocked. So one of the first things was actually to make sure that the community, not just in London, but nationally, came together and that we expressed solidarity across the boundaries of faith and culture about this attack. The second thing was very specifically to try to deal with the huge trauma that the attack had caused in London, most obviously to the victims and the families of the victims. And then the third thing, which was very much in our minds, is that we were getting further warnings of fresh attacks. And then one of the things that happens in these situations is that you get warnings that you can't be sure whether they're reliable or not. And then for the next few weeks, by the way, we were constantly in anxiety as to whether each time a warning came, you wanted to shut down the underground. But then over time, if you're not careful, you're actually the people who are making these, giving these warnings, whether they're going to attack or not, they're getting their way because they're paralyzing the city. So
did you think at the time that there might actually be a plan of sustained and concerted attack on London or on the UK more generally?
We thought at the time it was a distinct possibility that these attacks would not be one-off. And then we were getting further warnings of fresh attacks. And so I remember we were having meetings the whole time about whether we would be suffering another attack, whether each time we got a warning, what did we do about that warning? Because obviously you've got a duty of care to people. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you carry on shutting down, you know, the city every time there's a warning, then you're going to bring it to a stop. So it was and you're going to cause panic amongst people. So it was an incredibly difficult set of decisions during that time. And I remember we did take one or two of the warnings very seriously and decide to shut the underground or parts of it. But then we came to a point where I decided you couldn't just carry on doing this. And so we as it were took all the steps of precaution that we could without actually, as I say, shutting down the city, because that would have been disastrous.
I think people will wonder how, when you get this information as Prime Minister, how you evaluate the likelihood that this information is actually a forewarning of an attack.
It's incredibly difficult to evaluate it. And I remember one time when we were sitting around the table and, you know, there would be the relevant ministers there, but also, obviously, the security people, the police, and so on. And there was a particular warning that we thought was probably not credible.
Was this... how long after 7/7 was this?
This was maybe two or three weeks later. And I remember, you know, we debated it for a certain amount of time. And then I said to one of the people around the table, what do you... You know, what do you think? Do you think it's really credible or not? And they said, well, in the end, I'm afraid it's a matter of judgment, and that's for you to make. So in the end, I decided actually that we should not shut down the tube on that basis. Unfortunately, that was that turned out to be the right call, but it could turn out to be the wrong one.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Well, in ascending order, it's Portugal, Lithuania and Malta. Portugal, Lithuania and Malta, where they take most of the antidepressants. Possibly knocking some of the psychologist theories, because it's pretty hot in Portugal and Malta, and I think certainly in Portugal they have that sort of Catholic family thing going on, don't they? That everybody's around there for each other, so maybe not perhaps as we first thought. Maria is in Swindon. Are you on them, Maria? Good morning.
Yep, hiya, good morning. Yes, I was on antidepressants. I was going for a divorce at the time. It was quite a few years ago. The doctor put me on antidepressants called anxiety depression.
Right. Explain what that is. To people who don't know what anxiety depression is, tell them what.
Anxiety depression is that you're actually feeling worthless, you don't want to do anything, and you just think, you know, there's no hope at all. And that's the reason why he put me on them. Also, I was going for a divorce at the time, as I was saying.
What was the point that made you think? What sort of dark hole did you find yourself in that you thought, right, I've got to go and see the doctor and get this sorted?
Well, I wasn't eating. I had bulimia and an anorexia as well.
Crikey, you poor girl.
So I was actually going through that. My three young children to bring up as well.
Oh, my word.
And I was just left at the deep end. I had a house that was going to be remortgaged, sold as well, taken off of me.
Yep.
So I had hit really rock bottom. I went to the doctor the first time, and he said to me, look, you've got three children, get on with your life. You know, you've got three children to support, you know, you should sort of pull your socks up and get on with it.
Mm.
So the second time I went, I actually broke down in tears, went to see the doctor again. He put me on antidepressants. I took them for about 6 months, and I also had counselling as well. When I went for counselling, they were actually telling me what I already knew, that I was on rock bottom, I had low self-esteem.
Mm.
And I thought, I already know all this. But when I was on the antidepressants, the thing was, I wasn't eating at all, because the antidepressants were making me not eat. So they wasn't actually doing any good to me at all.
Mm.
Now, a good friend of mine said to me, come off of them, and then we'll help you through it. So I actually came off the antidepressants.
How easy was that?
I done it the wrong way. I actually literally stopped taking them.
You're presumably meant to water it down, are you?
You're supposed to actually to come off them very gradually. Well, I literally stopped taking them. I went to work, because I was working at the time as well, because my parents were looking after my children.
Mm.
I went to work, someone upset me for a very simple thing, I just broke down in tears.
Oh, dear.
But now, how I actually control, sometimes I do get depressed every now and then, and being through anorexia and bulimia, you never get over that either.
Right.
But when I do feel low, now, my key thing now, what I do, is go and have a run.
Oh, okay.
Exercise is the best thing for depression.
Mm.
Now, I reckon what the doctor should be doing, rather than giving out these antidepressants, which is so many people I've heard have been on them, who, once they've been on antidepressants, some people feel like committing suicide being on them.
Yes, but do you, looking back at that, how long ago were you getting divorced? How many years ago was this, Maria?
That was about 14 years ago.
So do you think you could have coped, though, without that round of antidepressants?
If I had somebody with me and turned around and said to me, look, sat me down and gave me some really good counselling, so my counsellor was through the an NHS, which wasn't very good at all. She was just telling me that I had low self-esteem and stuff like that, which I already knew.
Mm.
So to have a very good counsellor, sometimes you don't really need these antidepressants.
Maria, please let me... Well done to you, and I hope your life's all back together. Please let me move on to get other people involved. Really useful background. I'm very grateful. Listening to that was Rose in Hendon. You're using antidepressants at the moment, Rose.
Yes, I am.
What? May I ask why?
I was diagnosed with postnatal depression after both children. And after the first one, I was on antidepressants for a year, and like a previous caller, I just stopped after a year, and I was able to move on.
Hmm.
But this time has been a lot harder. I've been on a series of antidepressants. And I'm finally on one that works, and I'm scared to go off, and I can't get counseling. I was actually told I had to wait, over 6 months for an assessment. And then at the assessment, she said, what you really need is, cognitive behavioral therapy.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the wait is over a year. So there's no point putting you on the list. Here, we'll give you this dose instead.
How long have you been on it this time? The drugs on it this time?
Over 2 years.
Gee.
And it's
and if you miss
me from moving forward with my life.
It's preventing you moving. Did you say moving forward? I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yes.
What are the feelings you have if you don't take the pills? What is it that depresses you?
Everything. I'm incapacitated. If the postman brings the post before a certain time and I miss something, I want to kill myself because I feel like I haven't done what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm not worth anything. And the pills do help. I still have those thoughts. But the pills help me send them to the back of my mind to be dealt with later. And as soon as I miss a dose of the antidepressants, they all come back to the forefront, and I don't know what to do with them, and it just intensifies.
You have a husband or partner?
I do, and he's extremely supportive. And I get depressed periods. They come in phases.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some days when I just can't get out of bed, and he treats it as if I don't know, I've got arthritis and I've had a flare-up. I'm simply incapacitated, even on the antidepressants.
How old are your children?
The youngest is 2.
And the elder is?
4.
Okay. How easy or otherwise is it being a mum if you've got this kind of condition?
That's the worst part. Is it makes me a bad mother. And
I don't think it makes you a bad mother.
I could be a much better mother. And
I could have been a much better father. Where does that end?
I know the kind of mother I want to be, and...
My dear, none of us are the sort of parents we want to be. We never attain the actual gold standard that we set ourselves. Let's be realistic with each other.
And I think that most parents, or at least most mentally well parents, don't force their children to watch them crying on at least a weekly basis. I have broken down in tears in my child's bedroom while I'm supposed to be getting them ready for school. Mm. And that's just not good for the kid. It's not. So I'm giving them issues. Mm. It's bad enough I've got my own issues. I'm giving them issues now.
How expensive would professional help be? I hear that the NHS is saying it's going to take 12 months, which is ridiculous. Is it vastly expensive?
It depends on the quality. Last year and this year, I used up my husband's got private insurance through his job,
right.
And I've used up my quota for both years relatively quickly.
Right.
And it doesn't go very far.
Did it help?
It did. While I was there, it helped immensely. But I don't know why it seems that it helps more if it's ongoing. It wasn't like this with my last kid. It wasn't like this with my last round with depression. I reached a certain point and I just felt capable of moving on, and I still haven't gotten there this time.
Are your family in this country?
No.
Mm. How much is that a factor?
Probably a lot. When I went to antenatal classes before my first child, the instructor told me that I was a high risk because my parents weren't in the country. But that's neither here nor there. There's nothing to do about it.
No, but we need to be aware of it, don't we?
Well, I would agree that if there was something to do about it, it would work to be aware of it.
Sure.
But if I focus on it too much, it just makes it worse.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. No, well, I don't want to do that. And is there a history of problems in your family?
Yes.
With your mom?
My mother... actually, it's difficult to find someone in my nuclear family who hasn't had... mental issues, but
okay.
It goes back for a while. And in fact, I had it as an adolescent, but by the time I was 16, the doctor said it it's gone. It was probably just hormonal. You should be good. Mm. And then my hormones changed again, and it came right back.
Oh man! And how supportive is your circle of friends, other women and girlfriends?
I have to admit that I don't really have one here. I was relatively new to the country when I got pregnant.
Right.
And my motivation to go out and socialize has not been high enough to build that circle of friends you're talking about.
Even through the kids? Because normally when you become, particularly if you're a mum and if you're at home, but obviously dads as well, normally they introduce you to a whole new circle, the children, of parents.
Yeah, they're the women that you say, hi, how are you to at pickup, those aren't people that you... If you let them know that you're depressed, that's the end. You don't...
Yeah, they don't know how to handle it.
Something you discuss.
Yeah, no, it's like saying you had cancer years ago. Nobody quite knows what to say or where to look, do they?
Right, exactly. It wouldn't be worth what it would do to my son's social life.
Mm. Oh, boy, so what are you going to do? You can't wait 12 months.
Well, no, the doctor actually wouldn't put me on the list because of the 12-month wait. So I'm holding my breath, waiting for things to get better.
Right. Man. Those days when you can't get out of bed, what is going through your mind?
Guilt and... a horrible mix of guilt and apathy. Because the world has gone to pot anyway, and I'm the one who sent it there, and so I might as well just not exist. And
What do you enjoy? What makes you happy?
it's going to sound horrible, but socialising with friends actually makes me really happy. I just haven't... I haven't made that many here.
Right. How long have you been here?
6 years.
Right, okay. But do you like a particular type of music or food or, I don't know, book or whatever it might be, TV show, movie, something?
I've been using a lot of... I use fiction as an escape, which is just another form of trying not to exist for a few hours. Right. I'll watch TV and I'll read a book.
Right.
When I was a teenager, I would listen to heavy metal to make me happy, but that I can't really do around the kids.
No, right. A lot of people can't do it at the best of times anyway. It's pretty tough music to listen to. So you can't focus on something. There's not like a memory that you can focus on when you're starting to feel a little bit down. You can think, oh, boy, what about that fantastic holiday I had on the beach with my husband or whatever it might be. I went round an art gallery with my husband. We had the most fantastic time looking at the paintings or something. You can't focus on that.
I don't want you to misunderstand. I have a wonderful life with my husband and my children, but when I am depressed, if I think about a time I was happy, it makes me feel worse for being depressed at the moment. It's not rational. It's not.
No, it's not. It's not at all. It's not going to get some
anyway,
news out there.
So the NHS needs more therapy. That's the reason why.
It does. It does. It does.
Acceptable.
All right. Listen, you promised to stay in touch, weren't you?
Yes, thank you.
Give me a call. I really want to talk to you again soon and have yourself as good a weekend as you can in that situation, Rose. Thank you.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Thousands of British tourists are effectively being evacuated from Tunisia after the Foreign Office warned that another terrorist attack was highly likely. Tour operators were desperately organising extra flights back to Britain last night after the government told holidaymakers they were not safe and advised against non-essential travel. It is as close as you will get, really, to the government saying, get the hell out of here. This is the Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond.
We have now completed an assessment of the security measures in tourist areas. And while we are working with the Tunisian authorities to further strengthen those measures, we judge that more work is needed to effectively protect tourists from the terrorist threat. We are in close contact with the tour operators who are now putting in place arrangements to bring their customers home as quickly as possible. I would advise British nationals currently in Tunisia to get in touch with their tour operator to plan their return. To those travelling independently, our advice is to return on commercial flights which are operating normally.
There are about 3,000 package holidaymakers in Tunisia, with an unknown number of independent travellers and a few hundred British residents. 2,000 of the tourists travelled there with Thomas Cook, which announced it was putting on extra flights to pull them out and have cancelled all holidays there until the end of October. Well, we'll speak to someone in Tunisia in just a moment, someone whose very livelihood is affected by this. We're also getting from one of the newspapers what the Foreign Secretary did not go into detail now, which is the information that it would appear has been gleaned, which has led to this particular announcement. I'll give you that information, that sort of background, that covert background in just a moment. Let's go to LBC reporter Charlotte Wright, who's outside the Foreign Office now. Charlotte.
Hi, Nick. Well, yes, as you say, the officials here have changed their advice, and they're saying it's because of the evolving situation since the attack is typically a vague statement from them there. But they're basically saying that the measures already in place over in Tunisia don't provide adequate protection for British tourists. Now, as you say, there's lots of people in Tunisia waiting to be flown back to the UK, up to 3,000 British package holidaymakers, as you say. And a little bit earlier, I spoke to one of them. This is Christina Scarisbrick, who's from Widnes near Liverpool. She's hoping to be flown back this morning.
We've been in Tunisia since Sunday, and to be honest, once we heard the news, we did want to come home earlier. That's not the staff's fault or the Tunisian people's fault. They've been absolutely amazing, and we felt 100% safe. But once the government changed their travel advice, everyone just wants to come home now. We're currently at the Sultan Hotel in Hammamet, and to be honest, feeling quite uneasy. Total lack of contact from Thomas Cook, lack of information. Hotel staff are amazing, but there's only so much they can do. We just want to leave now. We were still happy to come after the attack. We felt that it was still safe to come because the travel office said it was. It is getting a bit scary now, more because we're all being told different things, and it appears that they're getting everybody out today if they can, but not telling us why.
Now, you've heard a definite sense of unease there. The holiday companies have said they are making arrangements to get everyone back to the UK. And Monarch say they're putting on extra flights too. And as you heard from Philip Hammond, anyone who's already got a holiday booked to Tunisia and are due to leave in the next few days have been told to contact their holiday operator. If they go out, then their travel insurance could be invalidated.
Great work, Charlotte. Thank you. Charlotte Wright reporting, LBC reporting from outside the Foreign Office. Makes it sound so easy, doesn't it? We're laying on extra flights. We're getting those thousands of Brits out, but is it really that easy? I speak with Victoria Bacon, who's with the Association of British Travel Agents, who joins me now. Just how easy is it? What are the practicalities involved? Good morning.
Good morning. Obviously it's logistically challenging, but travel companies are used to turning things around fairly quickly. There are relatively fewer holiday makers in Tunisia at the moment than there would be normally at this time of year, given obviously the awful incident that happened a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, the government figure is around 3,000, they think, that are with package holidays anyway.
Yes, that's right, yes. Mm.
So what would that swell to in the height of the season? May I call you Victoria? Is that all right if I call you Victoria?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
Victoria, what would that swell to in the height of the summer season?
It would typically be around 20,000 tourists.
We normally
expect at this time of year. Yeah. So, but as I say, since obviously the horrendous incident a couple of weeks ago, quite a few people have been choosing to either amend or cancel their bookings. Most tour operators have given their customers the option to do that in the last couple of weeks.
The
numbers there are fewer than we'd normally expect at this time of year.
Yes, my reporter played out an interview there that she managed to get with a woman who finds herself in Tunisia and is trying to get out. She only arrived there last Sunday. How surprised or otherwise are you that holidaymakers are still going to Tunisia in any numbers at all anyway?
Well, I think people will follow Foreign Office advice, which I think is exactly the right thing to do. The Foreign Office advice has carried a high security threat. But as we know, unfortunately, that high security threat applies to a lot of destinations. Even the UK has a heightened state of security at the moment. I mean, it's one of the really, frightening things in terms of terrorism. The threat of terrorism does exist and it exists in a lot of places. So the key thing, I think, is following Foreign Office advice. That has now changed, and I think it's quite understandable that people now feel that actually they do want to leave the country. I mean, the great tragedy, obviously, for it's for the Tunisian holiday market. It's a fantastic destination. And
have you been there, Victoria?
I have, yes, and it's a beautiful country and with very, very friendly people. So it's a great shame for them.
Well, we've got a figure here that Tunisia depends for around 15% of its GDP, of its economy, as reliant on tourism. So that's a heck of a percentage to suddenly lose. How long does it take if we look at past examples of problems, say, where else can we look? Say, Kenya or Egypt. How long does it take for a country to effectively rehabilitate itself in the eyes of tourists?
It really varies, depending on the nature of the incident. Generally speaking, if it's a one-off incident, then we would see an immediate short-term impact. But actually, things do it's fairly resilient over the kind of longer term, and things do bounce back reasonably quickly. Having said that, if there are a number of incidents, then I think it's about confidence and people having confidence in the market. I think the Foreign Office has come out and said we are going to carry on reviewing security measures in Tunisia. And who knows where we'll be sort of in 6 months or a year's time in terms of them looking at that. They do keep it under constant review. We have to keep in contact with them to understand all of that, and obviously our tour operator members do that as well. So
yes, yes.
It's very difficult to sort of say one size fits all. Typically, if it's one incident, then things do bounce back pretty quickly. But Kenya has suffered undoubtedly because it's had a couple of incidents.
Yes,
and obviously heightened security there as well. So
and of course, this isn't really your concern for the Association of British Travel Agents. It's more the concern of the Tunisian Tourist Board or whatever they call themselves. But ultimately, to get folk back, presumably a lot of this is price driven. Let's be candid. If folk think they can have a fantastic holiday there, family with two children, and they can get it for, I don't know, £199 or something, that is a driver, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if it's a family holiday, but I think, obviously, if the Foreign Office have got advice against all potential travel, it's really important that people don't travel. Operators won't have programmes in place. Your travel insurance will be invalidated as well. So, we would certainly advise, holidaymakers don't travel to countries where that advice, or don't travel to regions of countries where that advice is in place. But ultimately, yes, it's true that if that advice is then lifted, then you'll probably see very competitive pricing.
Yes, to try and get the folk to get back. That's what I was expecting. OK, thank you, Victoria Bacon. You're with the Association of British Travel Agents. Again, it's quite strange. I've been to quite a bit of that part of the world, but I've never actually been to Tunisia again. I'd love to hear from you if you had. What would it take? How sort of price would it be before you get on there? Are you actually planning a holiday to Tunisia? Have you got it booked? Because let's face it, if it goes up from 3,000 to 20,000, there's every possible chance you're listening right now and you've got a holiday booked. What are you going to do? And how would you manage to go someplace else with the family? Also, that announcement from the Foreign Secretary, from Philip Hammond, what is the intelligence that they've got, or that Britain has now managed to get, that made it necessary for the Foreign Secretary to give that statement yesterday? What have they discovered about the situation in Tunisia? Mike's in Gosport. Now, I know we've spoken about this before, Mike, but it's good to have you on, because just remind everybody what you do for a trade. Good morning.
I'm a travel agent.
So it falls to you in some instances. Have you got people out there now in Tunisia?
Luckily, personally, I haven't, but obviously lots of my colleagues have. And I just wanted to get across one point, because there will be a lot of grumbling about so-called profiteering over this. I need to point out that most of the 20,000 people a week who were going this summer would have booked months and months ago. It's always been a low-cost destination. Now, suddenly, there are 20,000 people a week, potentially, looking for a replacement holiday. That's not to mention the French and Germans. There's another 10 or 20,000 of them who won't be going. Though, interestingly, the Germans have not yet pulled their people out, whereas we have. We're the first to move on this.
Yes.
Now, this will cost the tour operators millions, because they will have to give everybody who's not going a refund. They've had to pay for all these empty planes to go out. Yeah. I'm not asking you to feel sorry for them, but I'm just pointing out that, you know, they are not rubbing their hands with glee, because the price of everything else, unfortunately, holidays to Spain and all the traditional
Mike, you say it's low cost. Typically, for a family of four right now, for I don't know, a week or a fortnight, however you do it, what sort of money are we talking about, Mike?
Well, obviously it varies a lot, but you can take a family out. You could have taken a family out there for £1,000,
right?
Maybe $1,500.
Yeah.
A bit later on in the school holidays.
Right.
Don't forget, we're competing for hotels with everybody else in Europe.
Yes.
But places, you know, people, they're going to end up paying double to get to Spain or Malta or Greece is still reasonably good value, because, understandably, some people are slightly wary about booking Greece.
But this is the collapse of the euro, of course.
Understandable.
Yeah. And just lastly, and now obviously that we have a Foreign and Commonwealth Office advice, the situation has changed, but prior to Philip Hammond's announcement yesterday, if somebody had phoned a travel operator and said, look, I don't want to go to New Zealand just because I'm nervous, can I get my money back? What would the answer be then?
Okay, well, under normal circumstances, it would be the booking conditions apply. But as a goodwill gesture, for the last few weeks, all the major tour operators have been giving people the opportunity to change, even though the Foreign Office had not issued a ban as such. We've got no choice. We have to abide by the Foreign Office regulations, because otherwise we're second-guessing their intelligence. So if they say, I mean, they didn't say it's safe to go. I mean, they hedged their bets, didn't they? They said heightened risk.
Yeah.
But they did not say, we advise against, as soon as they use that phrase, we advise against all non-essential travel, things kick in.
Okay. I will leave it there, Mike. I know you're more information, but I have to move on.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
If I may, I just want to introduce a small plug. Thank you very much for pointing that out, Nick. I just want to introduce a small plug for the return of the Sainsbury's Anniversary Games.
Wow.
Coming up 24th of July, Friday 24th to Sunday 26th of July, absolute festival of sport in the Olympic Park. Usain Bolt, Christina Hurugu, Jessica Ennis-Hill, Mo Farah, Greg Rutherford, and Paralympians like David Weir, Ellie
Simmons.
Good
to see Mo Farah running again.
Sophie Christensen and others. Oh, that's well, certainly what it says in the City Hall brief. I mean, if City Hall are wrong about this, I will eat my hat. But well, we're going to be very careful. But too much hat eating going on recently. That's what they say, and it will be superb.
No, that'll be the first time we've seen Mr. Farah since those unfounded allegations. I was thinking.
It will be superb. It will be a wonderful, and it's the reopening of the stadium. The stadium is looking unbelievable. It's the biggest cantilevered roof anywhere in the world.
I don't know if it gets better than this.
It doesn't get better. It's a most wonderful opportunity. So get online, folks. QueenElizabethPark.co.uk.
It almost sounds like you're reading this, you know. Almost.
Well, I won't deny I've got a bit of paper in front of me, but I'd happen to know it anyway. It'll be superb.
Okay, give us the website then, without looking down. Give me the website.
Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park.co.uk. Find out all about it. Okay, we're now going to Mark in Mile End.
Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm very well, sir. Very well, thank you.
Good, good, good. Listen, first of all, let me just put a myth to bed. I voted Conservative, and I've also voted to strike. So the political nonsense, if we can put that to bed now.
All right, right.
You're a Conservative voting tube driver, as I thought.
Yes, absolutely. This union, you said about the union's putting the deal to its members. You can't believe the union hasn't put the deal to its members.
I don't, yeah.
I don't know whether you... I don't know whether you were in the meeting or not, and I've got to go with what ASLEF have told me, and they're a pretty transparent union.
Yeah.
According to them, the offer of the £2,000, which was... wasn't consolidated into the annual salary, so any driver which was unfortunate to pass out just after payment but would then be expected to run full night duties wouldn't qualify for that payment, which is a massive downfall straight away. That they were given 6 hours. Apparently this offer was made at 12:30 in the afternoon yesterday, and the TfL bosses or whoever was in the meeting had turned around to the union bosses and said, this is the offer, you've got until 6:30 to accept it. Otherwise, the offer's being withdrawn, and that's it. Tough luck. Now, how do you propose that the union speak to all of its members, which is huge, a huge member population, in 6 hours to put this to them and get a feeling of it, you know, before they withdraw it?
Well, I think I think it's absolutely unreasonable. I think they should put it to their members. This is a very
Mark's point is you're expecting it in 6 hours. Well, I mean, I don't know how many thousand drivers we're talking about, but
no,
that would take some doing.
It isn't a colossal number of people to consult. It could be done very readily, and we think that, and I persist in this view, in spite of what you say, I persist in the view that this is politically motivated, and there's an absolute determination to go ahead with a strike, irrespective of the deal that's being offered. And I think that's a great shame.
But you've not addressed Mark's central point, which is the time it takes to contact. I'm sure
There's no time like the present, Mark. And here we all are. Plenty of hours have elapsed since that offer was made. Plenty of hours have elapsed since that offer was made. Let's put the offer to the people who are.
It's been withdrawn, Boris.
Well, Boris,
the offer was made at 12:30. Okay, to the unions. About the £2,000 lump sum. Now, the £2,000, they know it wouldn't be pensionable, which is what the unions want. The unions want something.
Look, I think a lot of people listening to this will be a lot of people listening to this, you know, you going on about you wanting your £2,000 pensionable or not pensionable, people will say, come off it. Give me a break. You know, workers are relatively well paid. They do a great job. They have very good, as many people have, you know, other callers have pointed out, by and large, workers on London Underground and other parts of Transport for London do get perks and privileges that others do not get. This is a very handsome offer to cover the change to a night tube, and I think it's ridiculous that it is not being put to the members.
If it's so handsome an offer, as you say, why do you think that the TfL bosses would not have thought, this is a really good offer, we're sure they're going to accept it, let's give them more than 6 hours? I mean, half of the union's members, at the time the offer would have been made and the time the offer would have been closed, would have been out there transporting Londoners
and
wouldn't have been able to hear about it.
This is completely feeble stuff. There have been plenty of time to put this offer to the relevant part of the workforce, and I think it's a great shame that it hasn't been done. I think the only conclusion I can draw from it, Mark, is that there is a determination to go ahead with this strike. And I can tell you this, There is the offer. Whatever happens, there will not be, I can tell you this, there will be no change in it. People can strike till they're blue in the face. We will go ahead with the night tube, and we will maintain our offer.
Should people be free, Mark, thank you for the call, should people be free to walk around London carrying the ISIS flag?
Well, I don't like people carrying the ISIS flag. I think that, obviously, the commissioner's spoken about this, and the decision was taken not to arrest the person in question.
Was that the right decision?
As I understand. Look, it's not for me to make operational decisions on behalf of the police, but I've made my views plain. I don't want people waving the ISIS flag.
That man should have been nicked.
Well, I think, you know, you and I aren't in the position of the officers concerned. We can't judge whether he was doing it in a way that was deliberately provocative. Without
Oh, so if you're not provocative, you can carry the ISIS flag.
Well, you know, we can't judge the situation.
So can I, if I'm not provocative?
There was a photograph. Everybody's seen a photograph of a chap.
Seemed to be wearing it around his back.
He seemed to be wearing it around his back.
So I can do that with the ISIS flag if I'm not provocative, can I?
I think, you know, the balance has got to be struck. You know, people might... There are people who go around wearing Nazi memorabilia. You know, the former shadow chancellor springs to mind when he was at university. Should he be arrested? You know,
well, he's not walking around Parliament Square wearing it, is he?
Well, and even if he were, I mean, I wonder whether it would be appropriate to arrest him. We live in a free country.
So what do you have to?
We live in a free country.
What is aggressive about if you start waving it?
Let me try and sort of
spell it out,
crystallize this,
please.
I don't want to see. If you go into a Middle Eastern city where, you know, there's a strong Shia presence, you'll see lots of black flags everywhere, or vice versa. I don't want to see loads of ISIS flags, or I don't want to see any ISIS flags anywhere flown in a triumphant way in London.
Flag flown in a triumphant way?
Or in any way. How about that?
But you can wear it on your back.
Look, a decision was taken by the officers.
Why don't we just ban the flag?
Well, because, you know, we live in a free country, and I think you'd have to have primary legislation to designate certain bits of iconography as being illegal. And I think that would be...
It's much easier my way. You just bang a desk, it's banned.
Well, you'd be the first to oppose that.
No,
well,
they were, banning the ISIS flag.
Some government would come in and they'd say Ferrari. I'm fed up with that guy shooting his man off. But he's banned.
A little while ago, we weren't able to listen to the IRA. The words had to be spoken by an actor. I supported that. Why don't we take similar sort of actions?
Well, there was, if you remember, that in the Pride March. You will recall that the police did in fact confiscate a flag in the belief that it was an ISIS flag, and it turned out to be a display of various sex aids. So
we have to tread carefully. Yes. I hear what you're saying.
So you have to be careful about how you approach this subject. Mm. I'm saying I don't want to see ISIL-dash flags around the city, but I. On the other hand, you've got to be. It's complicated to ban particular bits of iconography or agitprop.
We go elsewhere.
Can
the next call,
Colin in Ruislip.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Are you going to cancel the concession charge tomorrow for the day?
I don't think we'll be cancelling the congestion charge, Colin, because for the reason that. We think that it will, obviously, there will be heavy pressure on the roads anyway, and to cancel the congestion charge would, I think, be to invite very serious amounts of traffic.
Quick response from...
In the delays and the expense of the cycle highway, I suppose.
In addition to that, yes, Colin, I've got to put my hands up to that.
Okay.
Yes.
I remember the day when they used to make London parks open during train strikes. They used to open the parks so that cars could park in there. They did everything they possibly could in those days to ensure people could drive in. Now, apart from shooting out the tyres as they drive across London bridges, we do everything we possibly can to stop them. Colin, thank you. We go to another caller.
Thank you, Colin. So we get a Tony in Manor Park.
Yeah, hello, Wes.
Good morning.
Good morning, Wes. Well, it's what it is. I'm a firefighter. I've been a firefighter for the last 29 years. What it is, you've taken, well, you refused to give us back our 13 machines, and I just want to know why you actually done that, because we had a newsletter from our chief officer telling us that we were getting them back.
Yeah.
And then you stepped in for some reason and stopped it.
Well, I haven't seen the newsletter that you refer to, Tony, but what I can say is that we have to administer very tight budgets according to the results that have been achieved.
You've confiscated these 13 fire engines.
No, London.
Boris, the budget has nothing to do with the 13 fire engines. The 13 fire engines are taken from the dispute. The dispute is now over. It's got nothing to do with the budget. Nothing whatsoever.
Well, the issue is the effectiveness of the London Fire Brigade. And London's Fire Brigade has been stunningly good at reducing fires and reducing deaths from fire. And I congratulate firefighters across the city for what they are achieving. And that has been achieved, even with, as I remember the case, the 13 machines being effectively sequestered for use in case of emergency, in a case of strike. Now, the question is,
where are they?
What is the? They are in the possession of the fire brigade, or in possession of the LFIPA, I should say, and I can't give you the specific locations of them. But well, you know,
why can't they have them back?
Well, the objective.
So they've gone. They weren't actually requisitioned, were they? They were taken.
Well, they're there for the protection of Londoners in the event of a strike action.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. On Breakfast here on LBC.
Okay, and we're going first of all to Ken, who is in
Luton. Good
morning, Boris. Good morning, Ken.
Thing I've been worrying about is if they're going to run trains 24 hours at the weekends.
Yes.
When are they going to do the maintenance? Because they can't cope with the maintenance now, so with extra running.
Yeah. Well, Ken, I think as I'm sure many listeners will
be
know,
sure to speak into the microphone.
Yeah, sorry, Ken. Can you hear me? Forgive
yeah,
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As many listeners will know, we run at the moment. We run the tube only, you know, until late at night, and then we start again very early in the morning. The moment, the proposal is just to start 24 hours at the weekends. So that will leave us quite a lot of time in the small hours to continue with the maintenance.
So it's not 24 hours then?
No, it will be 24 hours over the Friday nights and Saturday nights.
So you'll still have the weekdays.
So
we're okay.
You'll have respite, Ken.
It's okay.
You'll have respite during the week. Day nights when a lot of repair work and upgrading can be done. But there are plenty of metro systems around the world that do run 24-hour networks. There's no reason why we shouldn't do that.
Ken has neatly done in, and I'm grateful you can, is to usher in a conversation about the London Underground. We are just hours away from an industrial action here, a walkout, Mr. Mayor.
That's right. And let's talk about
Londoners
that.
Are furious. What do you have to say to them?
And they are understandably furious, because I think the thing is ridiculous, and it is
well-founded
strike. And I think the proposal for industrial action, which I hope very much will be withdrawn, I do hope that common sense will prevail, because what we're offering, as everybody knows, what we're trying to do is to bring in a night tube, which is something that millions of people have wanted for a long time. It will be a huge benefit to Londoners. It will mean safer journeys. It will be a great boon to the economy. And we're hiring more train operators, 137 more drivers. We're going to be taking on more staff. And what we're doing...
No, but you're losing 850 elsewhere.
And that's an entirely separate matter. But on the night tube, we're doing...
Well, you are losing workers, though, aren't you?
On the night tube, what we are doing... And this is a strike specifically about the night tube, Nick. What we are doing is offering a very, very fair deal. And a package of average 2% increase this year, RPI or 1%, whichever is greater in 2016, 2017, £500, you know, launch bonus for all staff on the night tube line stations, and 2,000 to help with the transition for train operators. Now, that's a fantastic deal. Fantastic package. Very good. We've received absolutely no response from the trades unions, and they've decided to go on strike. Tonight they're starting. There will be, I'm afraid, no service from 5 or 6 o'clock tonight, the service will start to wind down.
What time does the strike start?
The service will start to wind down by about 5 or 6 o'clock tonight. So people should beware of that.
Well, we've been talking to the union. They say it starts to wind down lunchtime.
And it won't resume until early Friday morning. So, you know, that is a massive disruption. I think it's totally unacceptable. And, you know, people should be aware that, you know, these people, you know, many of these drivers have quite a small working hour week, you know, 36-hour week, 43 days of leave, good pensions.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it's... I don't think it's right. I don't think it's...
Well, clearly they do. And in this instance, Mr. Mayor, you've always talked about mandate. Industrial actions should require a mandate. If we look at one union, ASLEF, 81% of its members responded, 9-1 in favour of strike action. There's clearly something rum here that the union does not like.
Well, I disagree. I think that this is entirely politically motivated, and they've decided...
All those left members are politically duped.
And they've decided to go for... I think there are a lot of people who think that the result of the general election was not what they wanted or expected.
So this is payback time for a Tory victory.
And I think there's a big element of that going on. And that's why they've chosen...
So they're all Labour supporters,
that's why they've chosen Budget Day to do it. And I think when they look at the terms that we're offering, I think they're very fair indeed.
So if you're a tube driver, you vote Labour, do you? Is that right?
I'm not suggesting that.
You just said it was as a result of the Conservative victory.
I'm suggesting that the...
You're telling me if I go down to the London Underground, I won't find a Conservative driving a train?
I think it is extraordinary that the union leadership have not put this offer back to their members.
Mm.
We've had no response from them at all. And I'm talking about the union leadership now.
Yes.
Who are, in my view, politically motivated in this matter. And they have decided not to go back with what is a very fair offer, a very good offer, to their members and to sort this thing out. And I urge them to do that now, because I think lots of Londoners listening to this will feel the same sort of incandescent fury that you feel and I feel. It is just not right that a strike should go ahead when there's a very, very good deal on the table, when everybody knows that, as with the ticket offices, we're going to get on and do night tube, we're going to get on and do the reforms that are necessary, and this strike is unnecessary. It's pointless. We just lost Raj.
I do apologise. Just told him. We're getting back because it's about the strike action. He wants to ask you a question.
Go on.
But just while we're on this subject, Mr. Mayor, you have a worse record regarding industrial action on the Underground than Ken Livingstone. There were 16 strikes under former Mayor Ken Livingstone, 2 roughly for every year. There have been more than 20 on your term, and you've not even reached full term yet.
Well, let me tell you...
Why are you so unpopular with tube staff?
There's a very simple reason, and that is that I took the difficult decision, and I've modernised the system. And there are substantial numbers of people who've changed jobs under this administration. And yes, we've changed the configuration of the ticket offices in a way that the former mayor completely ducked, because he was the creature and the plaything of the unions. He had plenty of strikes too, by the way.
Not as many as you.
And he had a very bad and debilitating strike, I seem to remember, in 2002.
But don't you need to look to your tactics or your co-managers or whatever it might be if there's this level of industrial action, Mr. Mayor?
Look, my view is that I'm afraid in the environment that we're operating in, most of the strikes, by the way, that you mentioned, would have been obviated by the reforms that we are bringing in. So most of them would... You're quite right in what you say about this strike. It does reach the threshold. Most of them would not have reached that threshold. I think 23 out of 30... I can't remember the exact percentage, but two-thirds, I think, of the strikes would not have reached the requisite ballot threshold. Mm. They would not have taken place if we'd had the reforms.
But this one does.
And yes. The reason, I get back to my point, the reason we're having this industrial action is because we're having the guts and the balls, frankly, to go ahead with some difficult changes. Ticket office changes, driverless trains we're bringing in, and the night tube.
How close are we to driverless trains?
All those things.
How close are we to driverless trains?
We will. The next iteration of the new tube for London will be capable of completely driverless.
But when is that? Is that 5 years hence, 10 years hence?
That will be That will be the Piccadilly line trains, and the purchasing begins in 2016. The procurement.
So they'll be on the tracks. What, 5 years after that? I don't know the time.
I think they're on the tracks by the end of the decade, but I can get back to you on that. I think it's by the end of this decade.
And driverless trains on the Piccadilly line.
Well, I mean, absolutely.
No, they work brilliant. I use them on the DLR. They're fantastic.
And it is the way forward. We've gone ahead with big changes and reforms to the tube. And yes, we have a situation in which, you ask me to cast aspersions. I think most of the vast majority of tube workers do an incredible job
and vote Labour.
Well, I didn't say that.
Well, you lied.
No, because it's perfectly obvious what's going on. This is a good offer that we've made to the union leadership, and they have not got back to us. And I think they owe it to their members to put this deal to their members and to come back to us.
All right, let's talk to... We'll get another caller if we
can. Let's go to Peter in Chiswick.
Peter, are you there? Peter? No, we're having trouble with our phones. I'm going to have to take control of this.
Let's go to Nick. Here he is. How have I got?
James. James in Mile End, can you hear me?
Yes.
James. Yeah, right, go ahead, James. You're through to the mayor.
In the light of the Tunisian massacres of British citizens, do you feel that the British government has been negligent in their liaison with the Arab services and security services in Tunisia?
Well, James, I don't have any evidence to suggest that the government has been negligent in that way. I think particularly after the commemoration yesterday of the 7/7 bombings, everybody's thoughts are very much with the families of those who've lost loved ones in Tunisia. And to the best of my knowledge, James, the government, the consular service, the Foreign Office has worked incredibly hard to meet the needs of relatives and to try to sort out what was an appalling, obviously not just a terrible massacre, but an appalling amount of confusion and distress was being suffered by families because they didn't know what was going on. And as far as I understand the case, they've really tried.
James, where do you see the laxness that you're talking about?
I'll tell you exactly. The Tunisian government have been totally negligent.
Right.
Where were those troops on the beach the day before the attack? There were 1,400 of them the day after the attack.
Right.
Where were they on the day? Where were they sitting? What were they doing?
James, I'm afraid I can't answer for the military disposition of the Tunisian government. But look,
he is only London mayor currently. Goodness knows where it might end.
Obviously, what I would say instinctively is that it is difficult for any country to take the kind of preparations that we might expect in hindsight for a lone wolf, or I don't know how many of them there were, but an attack, a machine gun based attack of that kind. You have to be very, very provident indeed to be able to guard against that sort of thing by putting troops around beaches. And I'm sorry to say, James, I find it hard to blame the Tunisian authorities in quite that way.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC.
On FM, online, on your mobile, and on digital radio. Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
Are you too famous to travel on the tube?
No.
When did you last travel on the tube? Like Lord Sugar, when did you last travel?
I travelled on the Overground.
No, I wasn't talking about that. I don't know if you're aware, the tube is also known as the Underground.
I travelled on the Overground last night.
No mind what you did last night when you were on the Overground. When did you... Are you, like Lord Sugar, too famous to travel on the tube?
No, on the contrary. I'm on the tube virtually every week. When was I last on the tube? I must be on the tube this week, last week. I can't remember. I'm on the tube. Unless I specifically tell you otherwise. I took the district line the other day to where do we go? God, somewhere. We took the district line.
Well, where did you go?
Earl's Court. That comes back. Earl's Court.
Very nice.
And I'm constantly on the tube. As people,
Which tube line takes you to Uxbridge? People will testify
readily. And I hope that anybody who has taken a selfie with me on the tube, and there are quite a few by now.
Which tube line would you take to get to your constituency?
I take the absolutely beautiful Metropolitan line, which is going faster and faster and now has air-conditioned trains.
All right, we move to other calls.
And it is... when we get the new signalling in, by the way, it will be a totally superb service. We've already put the new trains in, but the big difference will come when the new signalling comes. And that is also the case of on the District Line, which wasn't working totally brilliantly.
Should we go to other calls, Mr.
Yes,
Mayor?
Yes, come on. Let's go to Lauren in Herne Hill.
Hello. Hi, Boris.
Hello, Lauren.
I'd like to agree with you to start with that we all want a cleaner, greener and great place to live in London. I'm actually a search agent, and what I'm ringing up about is empty properties.
Right.
Because my job is to look for properties for your first-time buyer up to big developers.
Right.
And there are people, you know, there's not enough housing stock coming on that's available. And yet every day in just a couple of boroughs, Southwark and Lambeth, I see empty properties.
What sort of empty properties,
Laura? Big houses, houses that belong to the council, houses that belong to individuals, and it seems that nothing is being done about it.
Well,
my question is, what do you think we can do about? What can you do about this?
Well, it's very interesting you should say that, because the number of empty properties is down to the lowest level since the 1980s, I think perhaps even the 1970s.
Who's keeping a record of that?
I
see it every day, and I see these properties year in, year out.
Well, often what's happened with an empty property like that is that there will be a very serious problem about probate, or you know, who actually owns the thing. And yes, in an ideal world, the state would simply step in and expropriate it, or and just say, right, too late, too bad. But that is very often the case with the properties that you're seeing. And
Some of them belong to the council, because I check on the land registry, and the council own a lot of these properties that are not being sold. They just sit there for years. There's a place in Dulwich.
Uh-huh.
I don't know if Nick might know Dulwich, being
I
a Blackheath person.
Yeah.
But there is a dairy there.
A dairy?
Belongs to an old dairy. Used for over 15 years. It's
right.
A big area. It housed at least 100 people.
Well, listen, Lauren, let's track down this dairy in Dulwich and flog it.
It's going to be my job.
No, it's been empty for 15 years.
Talk to my colleague.
Well, interesting, because, I mean, I want to talk to Lauren for a second, because what she's on to is incredibly important.
Right.
And, you know, the figures I have tell me that empty homes have come down, and you know, we're building record numbers of new homes and all the rest of it. But what is also true is that it is very, very difficult sometimes to get the councils to use the land and the property that they actually have available. And one of the things that we're getting going now is the London Land Commission, whose objective is to pool all this stuff that's owned by the NHS or the MOD or TfL or, you know, actually whoever, all the public bodies. But the big owners are the boroughs. They are the you know, the 600-pound gorilla here. They have the land. They have the property. And what you say about the dairy in Dulwich is true, that will bolster our argument.
Right.
Because that kind of land needs to be made available.
All right. Well, we'll talk to...
We'll get on to that, by the way. I'm going to get my team...
Lauren, please speak to one of my team. We're going to go to the next caller, if you want to say that name, Mr. Mayor.
Yes, sorry. Thank you. Thank you very much. We're going to Darren in Sevenoaks.
Hello, Boris. Hello, Nick.
Hello. Good morning. Good morning, Darren.
Morning. Boris, 2 weeks ago, Rotherhithe Tunnel was closed because of an incident.
Right.
Now, that's got a width restriction and a height restriction. So the volumes of traffic going through there are less than, say, the Blackwall Tunnel.
Yeah.
Yet the whole side of London was paralysed for most of the day. Now, we desperately need more river crossings. We need at least four.
Yeah.
And we need four quickly. And I don't mean a cable car, and I don't mean a ferry that's a waste of space as well.
Yeah.
Instead of wasting money on cycle lanes that are going to be empty we need more river crossings.
Well, you're right.
So that the arteries that people are travelling down to get to those, to get to the crossings that we have, are where people getting killed.
Yes, and we should, and we will do. And don't forget, Darren, that we're going ahead by 2020 with a new Blackwall 2 tunnel.
So it'll be built by 2020.
We are 2020 opening 2021. It should be there.
We don't want to have to pay for the privilege as well.
Darren. We're going to have a new crossing at Belvedere. And at Galleon's Reach, and of course, another crossing, because you want four, and you're going to get one. Of course, a second Dartford crossing. So there will be a huge expansion in bridges. Now, one thing I would like you to think about. Can I just
go ahead, Mr. Mayor?
Finish, because all three of the new river crossings are being considered now between TfL, DfT and the Treasury, and we need to get them going. You're right that they need to be got going fast. One thing I think that would make a great deal of difference would be if we stop the nonsense of bringing these huge boats up into the middle of London, because that necessitates the construction of gigantic bridges in East London bridges with bascules like Tower Bridge,
they be toll free, Boris?
No, they won't be toll free, Darren.
Why?
Because we need to build them, and the obvious place to the obvious way to finance the construction of these bridges is by charging the users.
How come if I live in West London, I only have to go about 5 yards and I can cross the river free? Well, should I live in East London, I have to drive for the best part of my life, the time it takes to put my child through college, and pay £2.50 for the privilege?
London's bridges were historically built on tolls. The first London Bridge, as you will remember,
where we are now,
Darren,
where we find
because
you're
probably the first London Bridge was constructed by John de Colechurch from memory. It was constructed entirely on tolls. We would have no London Bridge if it wasn't for tolling, and that is what we are going to do to build the river crossings that you want. But Darren, the thing I'd like to think about is, do we need these gigantic boats? Because if you massively increase the cost...
Do you mean these big cruise liners?
Big cruise liners, big ships, tall ships, all this sort of stuff, and they come all the way up the river.
Well, historic tall ships, people like to look at them.
They do, but the result... But this is a very good subject for debate, because the result is that you have to spend absolutely hundreds of millions, if not billions, on bridges that are huge.
Like the London... Dartford Crossing.
Like the Thames Gateway Bridge, or the Dartford Crossing. Yeah, huge, have massive land take that hugely disrupt the environment on either side, and the obvious.
Why don't we tunnel?
The obvious. Well, you could tunnel,
and we're
going to have a rail tunnel, for instance, at Barkingside. But if you're going to have bridges,
we'll have tunnels. I've solved it.
Well, you could go for tunnels, but if you're going to go for bridges, which is what people prefer and which are cheaper, then you have to go for absolutely a colossal expense. And some of the tunnels that we would be proposing in the east of the city would be very, very long indeed. They'd be, because you've got a long, long
stretch of water to
get underneath. And I think that it's time we considered not having these colossal... They add very little, I think, to the London economy. It's nostalgic and it's...
Hang on, what about your river bridge?
My river bridge.
Yeah.
So most bridges involve a river.
No, your garden bridge. I'm so sorry.
Yeah. That's why they're called bridges.
Yeah, garden bridge. Well,
what about it?
What's that going to do for tall ships?
No, there's a thing called London Bridge, which you can't...
Yeah, but where's
you can't take a tall ship under London Bridge. You could try, but it wouldn't get very far.
So your garden bridge is the right side of that, is it?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, why did you fall out with George Osborne over the garden bridge?
I don't think I fell out.
Yes,
out
letters between you and the Chancellor, obtained by the Architects' Journal, which I take regularly, reveal how the Chancellor overruled your wish to underwrite private funds for the bridge over the Thames. You'd each pledged £30 million of public money for the project, despite planning £12 billion in cuts to social security.
No.
So how big a fight was it with the Chancellor?
I honestly have no memory of any fight at all. We were both extremely keen on the project, and...
We took it to
George and said, could we have a VAT reduction, which would have been to the value of about £30 million, and he said, well, no, because that would set all sorts of precedents. But he thought the project was so good that he would bung £30 million, and I think he's quite right. I think it's a fantastic project.
So you two of you didn't fight?
No, absolutely not.
And this Architects' Journal story is all wrong.
it doesn't bear any relation to the facts that as I know them. Well, you know, this is the Garden Bridge. People endlessly slag this thing off, but when it's up, they will absolutely love it, and it will be a.
And when's that going to be?
Well, that will be in. We're going to start next year. It'll be finished 2018.
Oh, right, it's quite simple. We all know the Chancellor's giving his budget today.
Yes.
What would a Boris budget have?
Well, I don't think you could imagine a cigarette paper between me and the Chancellor. I will see. You know, I will see what he comes up with. But I can't believe I would want to I certainly will not be deviating in advance from anything that he.
But what would you like to see? Should child tax credits be limited to two children?
Let's see what.
No, but what do you think?
Comes up.
Let's
see what comes up.
No. Well, what would you do if you were Chancellor? Should child tax credits be limited to just two children?
Well. I think I'm generally in favour of reforms to welfare that take some of the cliffs, some of the poverty traps out of the system, and that encourage people to work. I haven't. I have to say, you have to forgive me. I haven't studied in detail the impact of any proposed reforms, and I'll have to do
but
that.
The general
after.
Spirit of it.
I'll have to let me look at it when it's out there.
Should the living wage be made compulsory?
I don't want the living wage to be made absolutely. I do want the living wage to be much, much more widely used.
But should it be made compulsory?
If you talk to Neil Jameson, a lot of people who've really led on this, London Citizens, all those people who many, many years ago got this movement going, they don't want it made compulsory. They don't want every single small business to be obliged by law to pay something that might really damage their ability to survive. Right. What they want is big corporations who are mainlining subsidies at the moment from the taxpayer, hundreds of millions of pounds going in benefits, in propping up wages to big corporations like Tesco or Next or whatever. I think that needs to be sorted out. I think they are using benefits as a reason, as an excuse for low pay. And they should pay the living wage. And I would like to see that. I would like to see a mass movement across this country to get that right up there on the political agenda.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC.
Tove Lundin.
This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Chancellor George Osborne joins me now. Congratulations, Chancellor. Everybody seems to be hugely supportive. I have to ask you then, as someone who served as Chancellor through the coalition, how much of a handbrake on your ambition were the Lib Dems? Good morning.
Good morning, and I'm speaking to you from Lancashire. Yeah, look, I think it's good to be able to deliver a Conservative budget because that enables me to present a new contract for the country, which says businesses are going to pay higher wages, but they're going to have lower business taxes. People are going to get that national living wage and lower personal taxes, but the welfare system's going to be less generous and something we can now afford as a country. And as a country, we're going to live within our means, but we're going to have to spend less. So, you know, I can offer a big contract, a new settlement for the country, and I can do that as a Conservative Chancellor in a Conservative government.
So just to come back to my central point, Chancellor, working with the Lib Dems was like trying to tow a piano across the ice, wasn't it?
I've never tried to do that, Nick, but the point I would make is in a coalition there are compromises. You know, I think we did some really important things over the last 5 years. You know, remember, Britain was in a complete economic mess 5 years ago and we had to take a lot of really difficult decisions. We did that in a coalition, but in a coalition you can't always put together the package that I think is most coherent. And, you know, if, for example, we tried to introduce the living wage a couple of years ago, I don't think the Liberal Democrats would have necessarily agreed to some of the welfare savings that are required or the business tax cuts required to support the firms affected by this. So it's only by being a coherent majority Conservative government that you can put it all together.
One commentator in the FT who lauds your work says the only thing that he could see that perhaps might blow us off course a little bit are the problems in Greece and a possible Grexit. How might that influence, obviously, world markets and indeed Britain, Chancellor?
Well, it is a very worrying situation. I don't want to pretend otherwise. We don't know what's going to happen. I think anyone who claims they do isn't telling the truth. Of course we're going to be affected. You know, we're a country that is interconnected with the world, interconnected with Europe. A lot of our exports go to Europe. And if you have a big trauma, like a country like Greece leaving the euro, that will have an impact. Now, that said, we're in a much better position to deal with it because we've been fixing the roof while the sun is shining as a country. We're, of course, better insulated. People have been able to see this Greek problem coming for, you know, many years. So we are in a better position to deal with it, but I don't want to pretend to people that we wouldn't be affected. It's all the more reason why we've got to deliver that economic security, put our own house in order.
The Labour Party are saying, the opposition party is saying, that the implementation of some of your measures could actually cost jobs. How do you react, Chancellor?
Well, it's typical of the Labour Party. They can't even support an idea that, like the National Living Wage. But that, I think, says more about the state of the Labour Party than the state of the country. What I would say is, look, a National Living Wage comes alongside taxes cut for businesses. And that's really important. And an investment in the infrastructure that businesses depend on. So it's a deal in that sense. And the independent body that looked at the budget, this thing called the Office for Budget Responsibility, which is completely independent of the politicians, it said, yes, look, a national living wage by itself would cost jobs, but if you put it together with the other things you're doing in the budget and the general state of the economy, a million more jobs are going to be created. And that is the positive picture against which we're acting.
To people listening now who own or run or try and manage smaller businesses, they, Chancellor, might have a concern over this £9 an hour wage. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say to them, first of all, you know, thank you for being a very important part of the British economy, and thanks for all the work over recent years in helping get us back from the brink. Second, you know, I want to help you by cutting your taxes. Yesterday I cut the corporation tax rate you pay to 18%. I cut the national insurance you pay for employing people, so you can employ four people full-time on the national living wage and pay no national insurance at all as a business. And of course, this comes after other tax cuts in recent years. So I think what businesses want is a stable economy, low taxes, the investment in skills and education that we also talked about yesterday, the investment in transport and the like. Put that all together and it's, you know, it's a great place in the world to grow your business.
Looking at some of the footage and some of the coverage, there was considerable excitement and support from your Conservative colleagues. Do you think Ian Duncan Smith is on Viagra?
You better get him on the show.
I've never
that.
Seen anything no, like it, Chancellor. He was so excited. Did he not know it was going to happen?
So anyway, I didn't see the, you know, when I was actually delivering the budget speech, I didn't actually see his reaction because I was very focused on reading out the speech in front of me. But then I watched it on the telly last night and it was great. And look, you know, I think Ian and I, we've worked as a team. You know, he's absolutely passionate about helping the life chances of those who come from disadvantaged backgrounds and has made such important changes to our welfare system. So it always pays to work. And we're getting people out of being in a situation where they're stuck on benefits, out of work, and getting them into jobs. And, you know, the good thing about this government is we all get on and we're all a team.
Yes, different perhaps to previous governments. Just lastly, one of the papers saying it's, indeed the Financial Times, saying it's George Osborne's most audacious gamble. The amount of work that you and your colleagues in the Treasury have put into this, does it offend you in any way to be seen as effectively as a roll of the dice, or do you just have to roll with that?
Look, it's a judgment, but a judgment based on solid experience over recent years of doing the right things for the country. And in the end, there's no point doing this job if you don't say, I'm going to try and fix things that have been going wrong in Britain for many, many years. The poor transport system we have, you know, and of course in London we've got these terrible strikes today, which should never be happening. We've got this, you know, the fact that, you know, too many of our kids don't have the right skills and the schools need improving. And, you know, those are the things that are worth fixing in our country, because in the end, what are we offering? A better life chance for someone, the chance to live out their dreams and their opportunities. And that's why we do what we do in this government. And, you know, I hope at the end of all of this, people have better jobs, higher wages, higher living standards, and are able to pass something on to their children as well. And that's what I'm aiming for.
And while I have the benefit of you on the line, talking about fixing things, we need to fix the problems of airspace in London. Do you support the third runway at Heathrow, Chancellor?
Well, I definitely think we should have a new runway in the southeast of England, but we've set up an independent report. They've come to a verdict. Now we've got to consult people, let Londoners have their say as well and not prejudge that. So we've waited decades for this. I think we can wait a few more months so that people have a chance to have their say. Otherwise, they'd say, well, the politicians have jumped ahead. So let's have the consultation. But I definitely think we need a new runway in the southeast of England. The skies are clogged up. And that's going to start affecting us, not just when we use the planes ourselves and go on holidays and the like this time of year, but also, you know, our place in the world, our place as a country where business comes to and jobs are created.
As a successful gambler, last question, Chancellor. How much money should I put on Andy Murray at Wimbledon?
Well, he was pretty effective, wasn't he, yesterday? I think he's up against Federer next, isn't he? I know it was a busy day yesterday for me, but I did notice that.
He is, unfortunately, yes.
I think he's great. You know, he's beaten Federer in the past. And I think, I think Murray is, I think it's fantastic. We've got a Brit again. Well, Andy Murray is again in the semis of Wimbledon. And we used to talk about the Wimbledon problem more generally in Britain, which was we hosted things, but we weren't very good at winning them. Isn't it great that we've got a good chance of winning Wimbledon?
Thanks for coming on, Chancellor. Chancellor George Osborne going through the highlights and the pertinent points of the budget. I'm Nick Ferrari. You've been listening to the highlights of my week at breakfast on LBC. I'm back on Monday leading Britain's conversation with the big breaking stories of the day, along with regular travel updates. Have a great weekend and stay safe. This is LBC.